You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for September 25th, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about the not-so-high risk of carotid artery occlusion, a potential breakthrough in diabetes, the potential benefits of text messaging for prevention of heart disease, coffee and atrial fibrillation, ICD-10, and medical errors. So first up, let's talk about carotid vascular disease. Now, most carotid endarterectomy these days is done in asymptomatic patients, the thinking being that a high-grade stenosis should be fixed because it could progress to internal carotid artery occlusion and thus cause stroke. The problem with that thinking, of course, is that it's not free to get your carotids fixed. There is a risk of the surgery or stent. Now, a new study from Ontario, Canada, which was published in JAMA Neurology, suggests that the contemporary risk of internal carotid artery occlusion and asymptomatic carotid disease is very low, much lower than carotid endarterectomy or carotid stenting. Now, I say contemporary risk because the issue here is that medical management now is much more intense and aggressive than it was when the original trials were done. Recall that the evidence for carotid endarterectomy over medical management came from the ACAS trial and the ACST trial, which were published in late 1990s and in 2004. This was a time when medical management was nowhere near what it is now. This new study from Canada, published in JAMA Neurology, looked at over 3,000 patients from a single center that were followed for over 20 years with yearly carotid ultrasounds. The study group of this study included 316 patients who were asymptomatic at the time they had ICA occlusion. 80% of the carotid artery occlusions occurred before 2002, a time when medical therapy wasn't as intense. And only one patient, 0.3% of the 316, had a stroke at the time of the ICA occlusion, and only three patients in the group had ipsilateral stroke. Neither the severity of the stenosis nor contralateral disease predicted TIA and stroke events. The conclusions were obvious that the risk of progression to ICA occlusion has decreased significantly and has now reached a point where it's substantially lower than CEA and carotid stenting. This is big news. In the discussion section, the authors point out that the 30-day risk of stroke in the CREST trial, now CREST was carotid endarterectomy versus stenting, was 2.5% for stents and 1.4% for carotid endarterectomy. But real-world data shows that the risk of carotid stenting and carotid endarterectomy is much higher, 11% for surgery, 16.7% for stenting. Now, the observation that ICA occlusion is substantially low risk is consistent with data from the ACS trial. In the medical management arm of that trial, which was published in Lancet, they had only 1.4% of medically managed patients that had ICA occlusion, and only one of those patients have ipsilateral stroke. In the editorial, two neurologists from the University of Miami started their editorial by noting that in the ACAS and ACST trials, the NNT to prevent one ipsilateral stroke with surgery was 100 to 200. And that was before 2002, surely. The NNT is higher now with medical therapy. They also note that recent but small longitudinal studies have shown that for people with asymptomatic carotid disease treated with medical therapy, the yearly risk of stroke is less than 1%. They also noted a gender issue. In subgroup analysis of the Canadian study, the authors found that male gender was a predictor of events. And this is consistent with a pooled analysis from ACAS and ACS trials, which showed no benefit of surgery in women with asymptomatic carotid disease. Now both the editorialist and the authors agree that there does probably exist a small subset of patients with asymptomatic disease that would benefit from intervention. This may be something that we can find with plaque burden or plaque characteristics, or perhaps the presence or absence of cerebral microemboli on intracranial Doppler. The other area of agreement was that the retrospective study was limited. It was hypothesis generating, but it emphasizes the importance of the CREST-2 trial, which is going to be an interesting trial. It's enrolling now, and it's going to look at aggressive medical management with either carotid stenting or aggressive medical management with carotid endarterectomy. So it's basically going to be a comparison of the benefits of add-on intervention. Now, I think this is really fascinating stuff. Perhaps we're at a turning point in the way we think about asymptomatic carotid disease. Perhaps there's some overlap between cardiology and chronic stable coronary disease and the limits of stenting, focal solutions for systemic disease. Next up, I want to talk about breakthrough in diabetes, or at least new news in diabetes. Patients with type 2 diabetes and established heart disease who were given the drug empagliflozin, an inhibitor of glucose metabolism in the kidneys, were less likely to die than patients given placebo. And this was the top-line result of the EMPA-REG outcomes trial, which was presented to applause at the European Society of Diabetes meeting in Stockholm, and it was also published simultaneously in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, this is considered a landmark trial because it's the first outcomes trial that has been positive for a diabetes drug. Now, EMPA-REG had about 7,000 patients in three arms, a 10 milligram arm, 25 milligram arm, and placebo arm. For the trial, the 10 and 25 milligram arms were combined and compared against placebo. The primary outcome was a composite of CV death, non-fatal MI, and stroke. And the results were positive. Not only was there a reduction in the composite endpoint, but more importantly, there was a reduction in CV death and overall death. Now, I like to talk about absolute numbers. For CV death, it was 2.2% risk reduction, and for overall death rate, it was decreased by 2.6%. The other notable finding was that the Kaplan-Meier curves separated very early. What was puzzling about this is the mechanisms, right? How do we get a CV death reduction without reduction in non-fatal MI and stroke? In fact, in the trial, there was a numerically increased number of strokes, not statistically significant, but higher number of strokes in the drug treatment arm. Now, it's hard to know what the mechanism was. It's not likely weight reduction because the curve separated so early. It's not likely to be blood pressure because we didn't see a reduction in strokes. And it's unlikely to be glucose because the hemoglobin A1Cs were pretty close. So since we don't know the mechanism of this trial, I think it's reasonable to compare it to another trial we don't quite understand the mechanisms, and that is the TACT trial. Now remember TACT, this was a trial of chelation therapy in type 2 diabetics with severe vascular disease, and chelation resulted in a 6% reduction in death rate. Now that's almost three times the reduction in death rate with this drug. That's food for thought. Next up, I want to talk about the potential benefit of text messaging for secondary prevention of heart disease. Recently, the AHA put out a consensus statement saying that digital technology and apps were great. They were promising, but there was no evidence of benefit. That changed a little bit this week. The TextMe, T-E-X-T-M-E trial, is a randomized control trial from Sydney, Australia. About half the group were half the group of patients with established heart disease were randomized to standard care, and the other half standard care plus four times weekly motivational text messages. Things like, "Have you walked today? Have you decreased your smoking or quit smoking today?" The endpoints here were surrogates, not outcomes. The Australian investigators looked at LDL, BMI, physical activity, and reduction in smoking. The results were slightly positive. There were modest benefits in LDL in BMI, in increases in physical activity, and most importantly, a reduction in smoking. The study made it into JAMA for obvious reasons. This is a randomized trial of a digital technology. And I, like Eric Topol, believe that the smartphone is an incredible healthcare tool. I can't help liking the use of the technology to emphasize the benefits of lifestyle intervention as a secondary prevention tool. I think in secondary prevention we underemphasize lifestyle, and this nudge intrusion seems worthy if it gets patients to quit smoking, move more, and eat better. Next up is coffee and atrial fibrillation. And this is a change for me in terms of what I talk to patients about. The old thinking, obviously, was that caffeine was an inducer of ectopy and arrhythmia, but recent data, suggest otherwise. Now, full disclosure, before I talk about this, it's clear that I'm addicted to espresso. I love espresso. But this week, another finding adds to the substantial evidence saying that caffeine is not associated with AFib risk. That's right, not associated. Now, this study was a two Swedish cohort studies combined with a meta-analysis of six trials, and the bottom line is easy. Just remember this. There is no association of coffee intake with atrial fibrillation. And here's why I think this is important. And I reported on this from Heart Rhythm Society a meeting this year in May. But it's important because we already ask atrial fibrillation patients to change a lot. We ask them to decrease their calorie intake. We ask them to decrease their alcohol intake. And we ask them to decrease stress. So the least we can do is let them have their coffee in the morning. Now, that said, I'm not saying some people don't have a sensitivity to caffeine. And obviously, if caffeine makes them have more ectopy and palpitations, they have to choose between having the skips, jumps, and flutters or having the coffee. Finally, ICD-10 is just about here. My colleague on the heart.org on Medscape, Seth Bilizarian, just filed a blog on this. He's dreading ICD-10, and so am I. ICD-10 and things like this are a distraction. It ultimately diminishes the doctor-patient relationship, and it's awful, shameful, terrible. And this leads me to the Institute of Medicine report on medical errors. Now, they just released a report saying that there needs to be reform to avert medical errors. Now, the Medscape medical news story on this has 94 comments as I tape this, and most of these comments are from angry, frustrated doctors. So I make errors, like all doctors make errors. When I make an error, I try to do a root cause analysis, and I think about why it happened. And for me, most of the time, most of my errors are anchoring bias, but right below anchoring bias for me is distraction and going too fast, trying to see too many patients. That's why I despise ICD-10 and modern-day EHR. It's these things that erode into our focus. It distracts us from communication. It distracts us from listening, from examining. It distracts us from thinking. And here's the problem. This stuff speeds up the part of doctoring that is best done slowly. And I don't know what to do about ICD-10 other than to say it bring attention to it and to just talk about how awful it is, and maybe we can limit these kinds of policy changes going forward in the future. So that's it for this week in cardiology. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the heart.org on Medscape.